Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Veteran Jeremy Ray says maple farming isn't making him rich, but he has found peace working in the woods.
I'm a disabled veteran, and I needed something to take my time. I needed to get my mind busy on something, and I also wanted to find something that where my kids could help and enjoy it so we could get more time together.
And we'll hear some tips from a farm-to-table chef about cooking with maple syrup.
We have an ice cream that's a buttermilk ice cream with maple, black walnuts, and a little bit of J.Q. Dickinson salt.
And wild ginseng, one of the most valuable plants on the planet, grows right here in Appalachia. But poachers threaten all of that.
They're just stealing, not my corn, not my cattle. They're stealing my ginseng.
You'll find these stories and more this week Inside Appalachia. Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. As we head into spring, we know that weather in these mountains is anything but predictable. But there are some seasonal foods that we can generally count on. Today we're going to revisit an episode that originally aired last March about a food that's made right here during late winter and early spring, and yet not everyone has even tasted the real thing. I'm talking about 100% real maple syrup, without any additives like a lot of syrups we buy at the store. Harvesting the real thing is very time-consuming, and unfortunately, like so many local ingredients, it's more expensive too. But maple syrup production in West Virginia has increased over the last few years. Farmers across the state recently celebrated Mountain State Maple Day. Sugar shacks and maple farmers opened their doors to show people their process, from tapping the trees to boiling the syrup. Some new technologies are making it more efficient for farmers to produce large quantities of syrup. In this first story, as part of our ongoing Appetite Appalachia series, the West Virginia Department of Agriculture's Chris Williams introduces us to a producer in Greenbrier County, West Virginia, who's been making maple syrup for nearly 30 years.
Brandon Daniels is a busy man. He works two jobs and is also responsible for 2,300 maple taps.
It's extremely hard work. You can't choose when the sap runs. You can choose when you cut your hay, but you can't choose when the sap runs.
Brandon has been making maple syrup in Greenbrier County for 28 years and makes around 600 to 800 gallons every year. But when he first started, he wasn't as successful.
Maybe a couple gallons with what we did in scorch and ruin.
He says technology has played a huge part in how he and other syrup producers in West Virginia make their product.
Reverse osmosis makes a huge difference. We can take out about 85 to 90% of the water before we boil it without affecting any flavor at all.
After the water is taken out, the remaining sap is boiled down and turned into the brown liquid called maple syrup, which is quite different from the syrup you buy in the store.
They're getting corn syrup, so it's just fructose, and it will run your blood sugar up very fast. Your body processes it very fast. It's not really, you know, anything as far as any natural minerals or anything in it.
Another advance in technology is tubing. Back in the day, maple syrup producers would hang buckets underneath the spouts. They would wait for the buckets to fill up and then carry them down to their sugar shack. The tubing connects all the trees and uses gravity to bring the sap into one big tank. The new technology and the vast amount of maple trees are causing a resurgence of maple syrup producers in the Mountain State.
You know, it's the first agriculture crop of the year.
And making the product is no easy task. To make 1 gallon of maple syrup takes anywhere between 50 to 75 gallons of sap. With more than 2,000 taps, Brandon's maple syrup production is one of the largest in West Virginia. Neither he nor anyone else in West Virginia is getting rich by making syrup.
If you had probably in the neighborhood of 10,000 taps and you didn't have, you did most of it yourself without hiring out a lot of help, you could probably make a living doing it. Many years ago, there was a lot of people in West Virginia that did it. They would do it most of them just made enough for themselves. You know, it was it's kind of a substance. It was their sweetener and stuff, and so a lot of people made it, and it's kind of went by the wayside, but we have seen a resurgence.
The maple season lasts just 2.5 months at best. It all depends on the weather.
We like to have the freezing nights and the thawing days.
When the temperature drops below freezing, the maple trees pull the sap out of the roots. And when the temperature warms back up, the sap starts running through the tubing lines.
I mean, ideally, if you can get it down to the 20s, you know, low to mid-20s at night and the 40s during the day, that's ideal.
But with technology, Brandon says maple syrup production is growing in West Virginia. According to the State Department of Agriculture's most recent maple survey, There are more than 61,000 maple trees tapped in the Mountain State. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Chris Williams in Greenbrier County, West Virginia.
As maple syrup farming progresses in the state, longtime producers like Brandon Daniels are sharing their knowledge with newcomers. As we just learned, it takes a while to grow a fruitful maple business, but the value isn't always measured in gallons or dollars. Jeremy Ray is an Iraq War veteran who was looking for a hobby to help fill his time. What he found was a way to heal his wounds with maple farming. The West Virginia Department of Agriculture's Jennifer Smith reports.
Jeremy Ray is the proud owner of Gully River Maple. It's the first season for his new venture. He heard about maple syrup through the West Virginia Department of Agriculture's Veterans and Warriors to Agriculture program, aimed at retraining veterans for careers in agriculture. He took one maple syrup producer's class, taught in part by Brandon Daniels, and was hooked.
It's been a long time since I've been excited about anything.
Jeremy's property in Nicholas County is dotted with bright orange ribbons.
My youngest son, that's how he learned to tie his shoes this fall, was he went with me, and every time we identified a tree, he was the one that tied the ribbon on it.
He tapped one of those maple trees early this season and was rewarded with a sweet taste of things to come.
And it came out of the tree. I mean, how much more naturally filtered can you get than that? That's,
you couldn't find anyone more surprised about this venture than Jeremy himself. The 43-year-old grew up on this land, but joined the Army National Guard right out of high school. He was looking for adventure, but then came the war in Iraq, and he was deployed overseas.
The day I deployed was the day my oldest son was born, so I was with him 24 hours and then wasn't back until he was 17 months old.
Jeremy doesn't talk much about what happened in Iraq and the things he saw, only that it changed him.
10 days after I got back home, I just went to work. I went back to the Sheriff's Department and tried not to think about it.
He worked for 14 years as a Nicholas County Sheriff's Deputy, all the while suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. He managed the depression, flashbacks, and anger, or so he thought, until the day his boss called him in the office in 2011 and told him to hand in his badge. When he went home to tell his wife, she too had had enough and walked out with their two sons.
I lost everything I'd ever worked for on November 11th, 2011, Veterans Day.
It took years of intense therapy and a lot of self-reflection, but Jeremy and his family reunited. Now on medical disability, he's looking for a new normal. That's where maple syrup comes in.
I'm a disabled veteran, and I needed something to take my time. I needed to get my mind busy on something, and I also wanted to find something that where my kids could help and enjoy it so we could get more time together.
His new workplace is far from the office atmosphere that triggered his anxieties. Outside with his maple trees, there's a sense of peace.
I'm by myself and in the woods. It's really relaxing.
West Virginia Commissioner of Agriculture Kent Leonhard, a veteran himself, says Jeremy's story is not uncommon.
When you think about what the unseen wounds of war do to our veterans and what agriculture can do to help them heal. Veterans with that affliction, they don't want to be in an office. They don't want to have windows and doors and be around a lot of people. They want to be outside, which is why our beekeepers do so well with it. It's why maple syrup is an ideal therapy.
Jeremy might be a maple novice, but he's spreading the word.
Maple, nobody around here really knows about it, but everybody around here could do it if they wanted to. You know, in West Virginia, there's, you know, untapped potential everywhere. If a crazy disabled vet can do it, anybody can.
Including Jeremy's 6-year-old son, Jackson, who tags along with his dad every chance he gets. Jeremy says one day, Gully River Maple will belong to Jackson and his older brother, a legacy of love born from the wounds of war. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Jennifer Smith in Nicholas County, West Virginia.
We reached out to the Nicholas County Sheriff's Department to ask them the details of why Jeremy Ray was fired back in 2011. They told us they didn't have any specifics they could tell us because there's now a new sheriff who was not around at the time when Jeremy Ray was laid off. Those stories about maple farmers were produced by the West Virginia Department of Agriculture as part of a collaboration among the agency, West Virginia Public Broadcasting, and Inside Appalachia. You can hear more from our Appetite Appalachia series on our website, where we explore foods and recipes with Appalachian roots. That's at wvpublic.org. So we know that maple syrup tastes great on pancakes, but what about cooking with maple? For some ideas, we called Mike Costello, a farmer and a forager of traditional Appalachian foods like ramps and wild mushrooms, and is a small batch maple syrup producer. But perhaps Mike is best known as a chef running Lost Creek Farm's traveling farm-to-table business, in which he and his partner Amy prepare Appalachian meals across West Virginia, as well as in cities like Knoxville, Pittsburgh, and Washington, D.C. Mike's also a writer and serves as a contributing editor at 100 Days in Appalachia. Hi, Mike. Thanks for joining us on Inside Appalachia.
Hey, Jessica. It's great to be here.
So your Facebook page, Lost Creek Farm WV, describes your business as a historic family farm. Did you grow up with Appalachian traditional farming and cooking? Like, how do you get into this?
Well, I actually grew up on a small farm in Kanawha County. And when I was in high school, I really wanted to get more into cooking. And I grew up sort of in the kitchen at a really young age with my grandma, learning a few things here and there. And when I decided that I wanted to become a professional chef, I started working in restaurants in Charleston, West Virginia. And, you know, I kept running up against this mentality that ingredients were only quality if they came from really far away. So, for instance, you know, if we had lamb on the menu, it had to come from New Zealand. It couldn't come from Pendleton County. Or if we had pork, it had to come from Colorado, and it couldn't have come from Mason County. And that, as somebody who sort of grew up with this really strong sense of place-based pride, was a turnoff to me, because I think my original inspiration for just about everything I've done in life, but especially in the kitchen, was kind of place-based. And even at that age, it was really something that I held on to. So, you know, I sort of backed out of culinary school at the time, and I went to journalism school at WVU, and I sort of dedicated myself to becoming a better storyteller, which is the best thing I could have done for having a West Virginia-focused kind of place-based food business, because the real value in Appalachian food and West Virginia food is the story behind the food, the way that we're able to talk about how food is more than just this kind of mix of flavors and special ingredients, but it's really a mark of something much broader and deeper, and that's our cultural heritage that we are all very proud of.
You mentioned storytelling. You also said that you grew up cooking with your grandmother. Do you have a favorite memory or story that you could share about being in the kitchen with your grandma?
Well, yeah, I actually have a few memories that really kind of stick out of being in the kitchen with my grandma. One of the ones that I think some of my memories with my grandma kind of depend on the season. If it's the wintertime, I can certainly place myself back in her kitchen making these traditional Christmas cookies. Me, when I was about 3 or 4 years old, kind of on the stepladder trying to reach into the mixing bowl on the countertop. And that's something that I'll always remember. But then in the summertime, you know, it's like the memories are in the kitchen, but they're also sometimes out on the back porch, snapping half runner beans and stringing beans, and all of the sensations kind of come back to you, you know, the sights and particularly the sounds of those beans snapping and the smell. If you're familiar with snapping beans, you know, you really realize that there's this kind of smell that brings you back. And the same thing, I think, with some of the heirloom tomatoes. That's why, you know, summer and fall is just such a special time to be in the garden, because it takes you back to a place that maybe at the time you didn't realize was so special, but many years later you're able to look back on it and realize what that meant.
You work with small farms across the state, including a number of maple syrup producers here in Appalachia, and have heard a number of stories about how families have been producing maple for a number of generations. Do we know how far back Appalachians have been tapping maple trees around here?
Well, it's a good question, Jessica, and we don't actually know for sure exactly how long people have been tapping maple trees and making maple syrup. But what we do know is that Native Americans were making maple syrup here in Appalachia in the Northeast long before white settlers ever arrived. And I think that's really important to point out because oftentimes, you know, especially when we're talking about Appalachian food heritage, we tend to overlook some of the diversity. And we've got this whole, you know, growing industry around maple syrup right now that kind of owes its entire existence to the presence of Native Americans and that heritage, and the fact that Native Americans taught white settlers those traditions upon their arrival. Now, the farmers that I work with, it is true that they've been making maple syrup for several generations, and a lot of this goes back to a period of time around the Civil War when sugar was prohibitively expensive, especially if you're in these kind of high elevation mountain homesteads where you're sort of secluded from the shops and the more the developed world anyway. So, you know, these homesteads were creating a lot of what they would use in the kitchen. A lot of these pantry staples even they would produce or they would barter with neighboring farms. And it's fun for me to hear these stories from the producers that I work with because it gives me something that I can turn around and share with our guests at dinner when we were using maple syrup from Radabaugh Farms in Upshur County, for instance. It's not only that we're tasting that syrup, but we're getting to hear a family's history of how they've lived off the land and how they've become really kind of thrifty and innovative and how they've, you know, built through all that a business that allows them to still make some money of making maple syrup today.
Let's talk more about your culinary capabilities, because in addition to telling stories about food, you're also a chef. What's your favorite way to use maple syrup in the kitchen? Can it be used for savory foods or just for sweets?
Well, I'm not really sure that I have one particular favorite way to use maple syrup, but we use maple syrup a lot. We use it in a lot of different applications. Maple is certainly most commonly thought of as a sweetener, and we do make our fair share of desserts. We make like a Bloody Butcher corn cake that's soaked in maple syrup, and that's really nice. And we have an ice cream that's a buttermilk ice cream with maple, black walnuts, and a little bit of J.Q. Dickinson salt that's become pretty popular, maybe one of our signature desserts by now. And although maple is considered a sweetener, and by the way, that's totally fine because in many ways it's a much healthier option than just this refined white table sugar that we're all used to, which essentially doesn't have much nutritional value. Maple syrup, since it's less refined, it still has a fair amount of antioxidants, and it's got some beneficial trace minerals that you just don't get from sugar. But even as something other than a sweetener, maple syrup is really dynamic. It can be used in a lot of savory applications, actually. Some of the examples from Lost Creek Farm, we make several salad dressings with maple syrup. We put maple syrup in our cooking greens, like kale or collard greens, as they're cooking down slowly in these braising liquids. We also raise meat rabbits here at the farm, and a maple braised rabbit is something that I think is really delicious. Sometimes we'll baste meats like rabbit or venison, even trout, with maple syrup when we cook it over an open fire or when we smoke it. It caramelizes really nicely, and the syrup really holds on to a lot of that nice smoky flavor from the fire itself.
So the foods you mentioned sound really interesting and delicious, but our family recently tried to buy more 100% pure maple syrup, which is, there's a big difference in cost. It's pretty expensive. The affordability of cooking with it just kind of seems out of a lot of folks' reach. Is there a trick to maybe tapping into their trees themselves? Would you suggest or encourage people to kind of do that to make it more affordable? Or is that kind of a little ambitious? What do you think?
Well, you know, it's interesting to think about this because there's a little bit of irony in this situation. You know, maple syrup became a tradition in West Virginia because sugar was prohibitively expensive. And now pure maple syrup is definitely not cheap. So, you know, we kind of found ourselves in the opposite scenario, if you will, from the 1860s when the maple syrup traditions really kind of took off for some of these families that I work with. But, you know, it's tough because maple syrup is just this incredibly labor-intensive process. And, you know, you want to reward farmers for that. You want to be able to pay farms in your community a fair share. You want to feel like your dollars are going back into the community. You know, I have a lot of hope for greater expanded maple production in West Virginia, hoping that a greater supply can maybe drive down the price some, and that we could see maple syrup become a little bit more affordable. But, you know, there are plenty of people that I know that just like us at Lost Creek Farm, you know, we run a really small, you could call it a hobby operation almost. We have about 10 trees that are tapped, and, you know, we'll probably get on a good year 2, maybe 3 gallons of syrup out of it, but that's under really good condition. So it's not necessarily an easy thing that I could suggest for folks to kind of take up on their own time to save some money. And, you know, this situation, it's not unique to maple syrup by any means. We have this with the sort of reemergence of a small farm economy, where we have this desire to support local businesses, and we have this desire to support producers that are creating products in our own communities. And we're sort of in this discussion about how we diversify our economies and we shift away from extractive industries. And part of that is supporting farmers that are going to be producing a product that is more expensive than we're used to, more expensive than we're used to buying in the grocery store, these sort of mass-produced products. So in some ways, it's just going to be this kind of never-ending struggle to really reconcile our values of wanting to support farms in our own community with the fact that that means that it's going to cost a lot more to do so, and that's going to mean it's kind of out of reach for some people, and that's unfortunate.
We've been talking a lot about sweeteners, which aren't the most healthy things for us. People often think of Appalachian food as high in fat and sweets, but is there a way to cook healthy when you're using traditional recipes and local ingredients?
Well, there's no doubt about it. I mean, for me, when I think about what I associate with Appalachia and West Virginia food, I don't immediately go to the biscuits or the funnel cakes or some of these things that have sort of been stereotyped as the only foods that are traditionally Appalachian from the outside world. You know, I sort of think back to heirloom tomatoes, and I think about canning and pickling and fermenting, and I think about harvesting healthy, lean deer from the woods and what's unhealthy about those traditions, you know. So, you know, when we look at the way that Appalachian food has kind of been categorized as a trend in other places, the foods that they'll pick out to highlight Appalachia oftentimes are these foods that, you know, are high in fat and they're high in sugar. And not to say that those foods don't have a place in our culture, but there's definitely something to be said for the way that narratives about food are narratives about people. And when you pick out a menu of Appalachian food that's just this sort of one-note monolithic high-fat, high-sugar cuisine, then, you know, there's a lot of our heritage and a lot of our history that we're really proud of that kind of gets left out. So we're sort of on this mission to tell this different story, and it's really fun. I mean, it's what keeps us going. When we put on our events inside West Virginia, it's so cool just to sort of see this response that's so proud, because a lot of these recipes are familiar to people, like chow chow, for instance. You know, I often go around and I'll put out something on the menu that's chow chow, which is this kind of fermented cabbage relish. Often it has green tomatoes. I often use maple syrup with the chow chow to sweeten it. And people will kind of come up to me afterwards and they'll say, you know, I used to make chow chow with my mom or with my grandma, and then I kind of stopped doing it because I associated it with this time in our lives, which was kind of hard. And we, you know, maybe we didn't have much money and we had limited resources, and I kind of intentionally blocked that out. But now that I'm seeing people making chow chow and telling this story in a way that's not at all embarrassing about our culture, but actually frames our cultural narratives around food in a way that people can be really proud of, then, you know, it's like you see this pride. And we've heard from people long after they've been to our events that, you know, we started making our grandma's chow chow again, or we started making Aunt Beth's pickles. And it's kind of cool to see that in this moment where Appalachia is sort of being so stereotyped in the context of a trend, that there's still this opportunity to sort of kind of take back our food heritage, if you will, and kind of bring back a lot of those traditions that are about as healthy as you could possibly get.
Mike, I appreciate your passion and your cooking ideas so much. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Sure thing. I was a longtime fan of Inside Appalachia. It was great to chat with you.
We've posted Mike Costello's maple glazed garden greens recipe on our website at wvpublic.org. In a minute, we'll meet a man who was growing and selling Appalachian ginseng, but poachers are encroaching on his business. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back.
Grandma's hands clapped in church on Sunday morning. Grandma's hand played a tambourine so well. Grandma's hand used to issue out a warning. She'd say, Billy, don't you run so fast. Might fall on a piece of glass. Might be snakes there in that grass, Grandma.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Appalachian ginseng root is a valuable commodity. A pound can go for several hundred dollars. It's not typically consumed in Appalachia. A lot of the ginseng that grows here in our mountains is sold overseas to China, where people pay top dollar for the root. Ginseng is often steeped in teas or taken as an herbal supplement. Like maple farming, it takes a lot of work to gather a pound of ginseng. Farmers spend several decades waiting for their plants to mature. For generations, selling ginseng root has been a source of side income for many Appalachians. But thieves and poachers are making it even harder to harvest, and the situation may be getting worse. Eileen Gua spent a day in southern Ohio last fall exploring what the ongoing conflict between ginseng farmers and poachers could mean for this native Appalachian plant.
It's mid-October in Ohio, and I'm trying my best to keep up with the long strides of 70-year-old Tom Johnson. He's patrolling his tree farm, and he's armed with a .22 caliber semi-automatic rifle. But the weapon isn't for protecting his white oaks, poplars, or other hardwoods. He's worried about his ginseng.
I think it was 1989 when I first planted any ginseng. It really doesn't get good until it's maybe 10, 15, 20 years old. Then you have some valuable product. Last year I sold it for $425 a pound. I could have $40,000, $50,000. That would help retirement. Little did I know. At that time, that there were poachers.
The first time Johnson became a victim of poaching, he was attending a conference out of town organized by the nonprofit Rural Action.
And I can still remember this older guy standing up, and he said, boy, this would be a perfect time for your thieves to get in and steal. So I come home, and sure enough, there was an area probably 20 by 20. It looked like hogs had been in there. They dug everything.
Johnson tried everything to deter thieves.
About 200, over 200 signs.
What did they say?
No trespassing, no hunting, fishing. Put those signs up, they'll tear them down. Had cameras, you know, I got some good pictures.
But nothing worked.
I was thinking one day, if I were a thief, what would defer me from being on someone's property trying to steal their ginseng? And I thought, if somebody was up there shooting, I probably would think I'll go over to the next guy's farm.
Not that he's shooting at anyone.
I'm very, 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 very careful about what I shoot. I shoot dead trees. My intent is not to hurt someone. It's to let them know I'm there. I have a gun, and maybe they might want to move on.
But they don't always move on, at least not immediately.
I'll go up on a hill, and at various times, stop and shoot. I've had people shoot back. Didn't hit me. They heard me shooting, and they were shooting back.
He used to call up the local sheriffs, but he's never been able to catch anyone red-handed.
My biggest mistake, I guess, was I didn't have them bring up their bags of ginseng. We never could find them. They didn't have any evidence. It was my word against theirs.
So the sheriffs just let them go.
And I don't blame law, and especially now in Scioto County. We have a lot of bigger problems than poaching ginseng.
The county is at the heart of the country's opioid crisis. Right next door is Portsmouth, known as the Pill Mill of America. In December alone, 33 people were indicted for their involvement in a drug trafficking ring.
If you have a drug habit, you can go out and steal my ginseng and get enough money to get you a fix.
But there's another challenge to prosecuting ginseng thefts. Law enforcement doesn't always know what to make of it, and even the word poaching is confusing.
Poaching, to me, is a kind word. It makes me think of eggs. But It's not. They're just stealing, not my corn, not my cattle. They're stealing my ginseng.
Over the years, the amount stolen really adds up.
I would estimate probably 10 times as much as I dug. I probably sold less than $3,000.
Ultimately, the ginseng thefts are about more than just his retirement money.
This is a heritage farm. My great-great-grandfather homesteaded.
That gives him a respect for the land and the root that the thieves don't share.
They don't dig it ethically and with the idea that next year they'll come back and get more. They dig it with the idea, I'm going to dig every plant. I don't care how small it is, I'm going to dig it. And I'm not going to plant the seeds back because I'll probably never be back this way again. In olden days, my grandfather, he knew how to dig it, planted the seeds back. That way next year you could go back and still dig enough for your Christmas money.
It was his time in the woods with his grandfather that eventually sparked Johnson's interest in growing ginseng, but it's not a tradition that he'll be passing on.
I really would hesitate to have my granddaughters out in the woods with the poachers, the thieves that I've encountered. I don't think it would be wise.
So it's not just ginseng that's being stolen. It's also the opportunity for younger generations of Appalachians to learn about their heritage, and that might be the greatest loss of all. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Eileen Guo.
That story comes to us from 100 Days in Appalachia, which is a collaboration between West Virginia Public Broadcasting, the WVU Media Innovation Center, and the Daily Yonder. This is Inside Appalachia. Earlier in our show, we heard Chef Mike Costello talk about his connection to local Appalachian traditions and foods. He even said that some of these old-fashioned recipes and foods can be healthy. But these home-cooked meals take time, and many people, even doctors, aren't familiar with easy-to-prepare meals that can be healthier for us. To change this, a new program in West Virginia is teaching medical students to cook healthy foods as a way to encourage future medical doctors to prescribe healthy eating as a way to help prevent diseases like diabetes and heart disease. Kara Lofton reports.
One of the things that we talked about is probably 70% of the adults that they'll see in the clinics have some form of metabolic disease that has directly related to nutritional status.
That's Dr. Rosemary Lorenzetti, a professor of family medicine at the Eastern Division of West Virginia University Medical School. Her co-teacher is CAMC Executive Chef Bill Dodson. Lorenzetti has offered this class for the past 3 years at the medical school's Eastern Division. The school has expanded the class this year to both the Morgantown and Charleston locations. Lorenzetti says she hopes that the young doctors will learn to help their patients make small nutritional changes that can make a big impact in health.
For example, find out if your patient is a sweet or salty snacker. But most people are one or the other. And help people find something that is healthier for them that would still satisfy whatever need.
Lorenzetti is also beginning to offer cooking classes to the public. Last month, for instance, she held a Cooking with the Clergy class for pastors in the Eastern Panhandle. For Appalachia Health News, I'm Kara Lofton.
Appalachia Health News is a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting with support from Marshall Health, Charleston Area Medical Center, and WVU Medicine. This show really makes me want to get out in the woods. And of course, it also reminds me of my grandparents. I can remember snapping beans with Granny on the back deck in the summer heat while we dipped our feet into a colorful kiddie pool Granny probably got at Rose's. I also ate my first baked potato with butter and salt in that same spot. Granny made homemade biscuits every morning until she couldn't any longer. She didn't write down many recipes. If you wanted to learn how to make some of her specialty dishes, well, you had to get into the kitchen and help. As a busy working mom, I don't cook every day, so I haven't practiced recreating her recipes much. I guess I'll have to get into my mom or aunt's kitchen if I want to figure it out. Do you have a favorite family recipe you'd like to share? Do you use healthy ingredients? Does it come with a treasured family memory you'd like to share? We'd love to hear it. Send us a tweet at InAppalachia. Oh, and one quick note before I let you go. We're in the middle of a pledge drive here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. To all of you who've already donated, thank you. If you aren't yet a sustaining member, please consider becoming one today. Your support is the most important and reliable source of funding we have to help us continue to tell Appalachia's story. Call 1-800-RADIO-87 or click the red Donate Now button at wvpublic.org. And thank you. The fiddle music you heard in today's show is from the archived field recordings at the Augusta Heritage Center, recorded in the 1990s by Jerry Milnes. Other music in today's show was provided by Dinosaur Burps and Bill Withers. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. He also edited our episode this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to InsideAppalachia@wvpublic.org or address your letters to Inside Appalachia at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. If you'd like to listen to any part of this episode again, don't forget, you can subscribe or download all of our stories on iTunes, Downcast, wvpublic.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.